EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind of it?
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merger 295. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Did we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
County dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls.
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show. How are you all doing this week? I'm Nick Hunter and this is the UFO Chronicles podcast. California is our destination tonight as we hear from James, and he has been an experiencer probably as early as 6 years old and has had several abduction encounters and recalls being taken on a regular basis. James is up next. But first, if you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
It is great to have you with us today, and you're calling from sunny California.
Well, rainy California today, but normally sunny.
What's the chance? Rainy California. Okay. Now, do you have some experiences you're going to be sharing with us? Would you like to start at the beginning, please, sir?
Yeah, I sort of call myself just a typical experiencer because we've all had, you know, similarities between our experiences. Mine started, my first remembered one was when I was 5 and a half years old. We were out on a family parcel of about 20 acres where the family homestead had burned down a few years before, and we were building a cabin there, a sort of rough house, you know, not a when you live in all the time, when it was more like camping, and we were sitting outside. It was, I was 5 and a half, so that would have been 58. All the adults and the teenagers looked down on me. I was, you know, a hyperactive 5 and a half year old. And so they told me to start looking for Snick. And so I was watching the sky, and that kept me occupied for a while. It was a weekend before I started kindergarten, is one of the reasons I remember it so well. And all of a sudden, we had this object flying above a pasture next to where we were. There were about 7 or 8 of us. And it was, maybe 500 to 1,000 feet away from us. The 5-year-old is hard to estimate. But It was shot off sparks, and the field was dry because it was the end of the summer and nothing was starting on fire. And I remember looking up at my dad and my uncle and aunt and their kids, and they were just staring at it with their mouths open, just frozen, sort of like a Steven Spielberg movie when they You know, he always was good at showing average looking people in unusual situations. And that's the last I remember. And the next morning, you know, getting out of bed, I'd come out and sit around the campfire while the adults are drinking coffee and we're drinking water. And the adults are all talking about the comet we saw, how amazing it was. And not knowing anything different, I thought a comet was something, you know, the size of a full moon 500 feet away, you know, throwing sparks off. And I actually talked to Colonel Halt, who was in Rendlesham Forest, because what it looked like was a lot like what he described. And they were all talking about the comet. And so everyone packed up and we had to head back into town. Next morning, I'm starting kindergarten. And I asked my dad what he thought of the comet. So I brought that up again. And he said, "What comet? What you're talking about?" And no one else had any memory of it except me. And I must have had missing time, because I go from watching my family to waking up next morning. And that stuck with me. And I remember in school talking about comets. And always in the back of my mind is that didn't make sense. And I remember a comet when I was in college was visible. And I looked up at it and I was so disappointed. And I got to thinking, how the heck could I think a comet could fly over a cow pasture? I don't know. And so I never figured that out. So I, as a kid, I had a lot of strange experiences where my parents took me to the doctor because I was a sleepwalker and I'd end up outside and knock on the door to be let back in. And so I don't really remember too many experiences around then. But when I was 17, I was playing basketball with some friends over the backyard and then walked back home and decided, you know, I'm just going to go lay in the park. And so I go and lay down in a park. But the funny thing about it is I'm laying down where they're planting grass, and I'm laying on peat moss, which is really stupid when you're sweaty after playing basketball. And I look up in the sky, perfectly clear night, and I see this, you know, a lot of stars in the sky. So the sky is black, but it's not dark black. And I see this lenticular-shaped object just above a hillside about 5 miles from the house, where a daytime airport was. And I'm thinking, that's a weird time for a plane to be flying, especially one with no lights. I realized it's moving too slow. It must be a helicopter. And it started heading towards Los Angeles. I was living in a suburb of Los Angeles called San Dimas, made famous by Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So I'm watching this object, and it stands out because it's darker than the background. And I'm thinking to myself, it's not a plane. It's not a helicopter. I would hear it because I'm close enough and it's so quiet. You know, I'm thinking, I'm not talking out loud. I say to myself, it must be a UFO. And before I even finish the O, it just all of a sudden does a straight edge, 130 degree or so turn towards me, and starts descending in a straight line right towards me. And I lose it for a second, but then reacquire it. There are very few things I remember as well as this. And it ends up above me. And I reach down and pick up a rock that was like one of those rocks that fits around your finger and you skip it across the pond. And throw it straight up above me. And the rock nearly hits me in the head and falls down. And so it must have been above 75 feet because I could have thrown the rock that far. And when it's right above, it's about 30. If it was 100 feet up, it was 30 feet across, but it was a perfectly ray. Where from the side, it looked lenticular. And then all of a sudden, I'm watching it goes over me and it goes over the mountain in a direction north of LA. And so I go home. Don't mention it to my parents. go right to bed, wake up the next day, and I'm all excited, but I know I've seen something, but I forgot about it for a while. And 50 years later, 55 years later, I think it was, I get regressed by Yvonne Smith. And before I went to the she runs this Close Encounters Resource Organization in Los Angeles. And just before I drove to her office from where I live in San Diego, I went by the park. And I'm standing there thinking, it went straight over my head and I just watched it go. And then I realized it went over a water tower that's to my right. How could that be? So she does the regression. I don't recover any memories. I'm blocked about the actual. I see everything in perfect detail up until the time it gets over my head. And then the next thing I see it head off. But the one thing I realized from the regression wasn't seeing anything like non-terrestrial entities or anything. What the regression and the abilities in order to recall told me is I'm facing one way, and then a millisecond later, I'm facing a totally different direction. And so in my mind's eye, when I think about it, it was going directly behind me in a straight line. But actually, it stopped above me and then made a turn to the right. I was like, they put me back facing a different direction. And then through high school and the rest of high school and college, I really didn't have any experiences, but sort of stopped there. That's when I started having these things. And those two instances really stuck out. A lot of my close friends, who I swore I never talked to anyone about it, but a few of my college friends, mostly my college friends were a little older than me that went to Vietnam and came back and then went to college. A couple of them said, yeah, you talk about it all the time. And I really don't remember, you know, discussing it much. But once I got into about my mid-30s, then experiences started accelerating up through my mid-40s. When I was 39, I was appointed city attorney of Fresno, California. And it's a big job, and so I was very concentrated on it. It had a lot of, in addition to political problems, after I was hired, a lot of people got elected to the council or were corrupt. And so I was constantly battling with them. And it was a very tough job. I had a large staff that I was worried about, but they didn't seem to care, the entities that were dealing with me, because I started being taken sometimes 2-3 times a week. And what really stood out to me wasn't so much any experience I had, but the after effects I'd have when I'd come back. One night I'm walking after a city council meeting in a summer night when it's cooler and Fresno's a hot place. I started noticing that every time I walked under a street light, it would go off. And it was pitch dark. And this happened 20 street lamps in a row. And if that doesn't unnerve you, I don't know what will. And then I started having paranormal experiences too, ghosts. One time I'm walking on the sidewalk in front of my house, and I'm not living in an old house. I'm living in a tract home. It was built in 1991, and it was, or 1989, and it was like 1995, 96. I'm walking along the sidewalk just to get a little fresh air. And this guy in a gray 1940s suit pushes past me. He doesn't touch me, but it's like he's trying to push me and just is annoyed, walks away. And then he totally disappears. It just vanishes. But like I was in his way and he was trying to go and he just kept walking and was upset with me. And we had people that would come dog sit for us while we were out of town, and a couple that would do it a lot finally said, we're not doing it anymore. We're tired of too many weird things happening in your house. you know, TVs turning on at 3 o'clock in the morning. They didn't do that to us, but they did it to people that stayed there. And so I had a lot of paranormal experiences at the time. And I had one instance that particularly stood out. I left the city of Fresno. I was at a council meeting in a rural community. And it was the week before the election. And usually that, you know, the city manager puts non-controversial items on because you don't want to create problems for the, you know, before the voting starts for your council members. But this was a very contentious meeting, and I remember all about it. And then I drove home, and I got home late, maybe midnight. And so I went in the walk-in closet and changed into what I was wearing to bed so I wouldn't wake my wife up. And then I hit the pillow, fall asleep. The next thing I remember, I'm standing on the sidewalk out front of the house. It's about, 10, 12 degrees or 40 in Fahrenheit, somewhere around there, 45, 50. And the wind was blowing across, and I was in boxer shorts and a t-shirt. And as soon as I came awake or became aware where I was, I said to them out loud, "So that's what they look like." And so I look at the front door and I go, "I've got to remember all this." And at the time I was saying this, there was a bright, wider than sunlight above my head. Yet I didn't look up. I was walking along thinking to myself, "I've got to remember all this." And so I remember the hairs on my legs blowing and they were cold. I remember taking steps in the barefoot on the cement walkway. And I remember going up and reaching the door handle and thinking, "God, I hope this thing's open." And I walked into the house and go to bed. And the next morning, I didn't have to work. And I actually taken off 2 weeks because of the election and the follow-up, there weren't going to be any council meetings. And so I had scheduled 2 legal seminars out of town and had all my clients, you know, realizing, because back then I think I had a primitive cell phone, but it was hard to get in touch with people back then. And so the next morning I woke up and the entire room was not spinning. It was like it was going from left to right across my field of vision and then jumped back to the beginning. And this kept up. And within an hour, I probably threw up about 200 times. And my wife got me into our doctor on an emergency basis that morning, just in his office. He said that I probably had a virus or got a blow to the head. And I didn't say to him, you know, I just got dropped off by a spaceship, you know, being a city attorney and doing working for politicians, you don't say things like that, even to your doctor or anyone at that point. And so for the next 2 weeks, I couldn't drive. I took anti-nausea medication and eventually it went away. And it was something in my inner ear. The doctor said either a virus or a blow to the head. And so about 2 weeks later, I was starting to regain my focus. And I noticed that I had 2 scars right here, perfectly formed, that I never had before, deep scars. You know, had no idea where they came from. I have a similar scar on the other side that's not nearly as deep, and it's taken 71 years to form. This one just appeared overnight. And so it always stuck with me. I just never figured out what happened. I had a good suspicion, but why would they cut my head open there? And so I was regressed by Yvonne Smith, you know, about 20, 30 years later on this. And I actually saw something because I've been regressed several times. And, you know, Yvonne jokes that I'm a lawyer and so I'm not used to taking directions. I get a lot before and after, but in this case, I actually got a little bit during what I think was my abduction. My body, basically, it came from the head down to the toe, just froze, you know, and I couldn't move. but I could move my eyelids a little bit, and they were closed, but the light, I could see a light in a room, and so I struggled to just barely open my eyes, and I saw the top half of an entity, maybe an inch or so from my face, staring right at me, and it had the typical big almond eyes, wraparound sunglasses, and then it moved back, and then there was some sort of boomerang type object that I could just see a shadow of with my eyes closed in intense light, where you can see through your eyelids, you know, like looking into a bright light. And when I saw this, this boomerang was like moving in a circular pattern one direction. And then after a couple of minutes, I saw it again, and it was moving the opposite direction. And so I really couldn't figure it, but it was right over at the spot where I ended up seeing the scars later. And with Yvonne, after I had the regression, I went home, drove back down to San Diego from her office in La Cañada near Los Angeles. And I decided, you know, I wanted to read something. I was too wound up to go to sleep. So I went in, I just finished a book and didn't have a new one. This is the before Kindle. So what I did is I went into my bookshelf with a lot of these books that are behind me right now on UFOs, and I looked for bookmarks, because a lot of times I would read a book and then stop and buy another one and never finish the first one. And so I saw one. It was Whitley Strieber's Communion Letters, and it had a bookmark in it. So I just picked it up and started reading from where the bookmark was. And so I read about 3 pages, and that helped put me to relax me, and I went to sleep. And so I read to the end of a chapter, and then the next morning I took it to breakfast with me to read. And the next chapter was about a guy who wrote to Whitley to tell him he had had a weird experience where he was taken. He was frozen. He saw a boomerang-shaped object go one direction, and it pulled open his scalp, and they dropped some crystals or something that looked, you know, like an emerald or something like that into the hole that they'd made in his head. And then they waved the wand back, and that recovered put his skin back in perfect place. He asked Whitley if anyone had ever heard of that. And I'm gobsmacked at that point, because I looked at the bookmark, because I used to use receipts for bookmarks. And I had bought the book a year before I had the incident in 1997. The incident was in 1998. But I had stopped reading the chapter before. And so I was reading it for the first time, and the guy had the same experience I had. He had a little more detail. And so that one has probably stood out more than any I've ever had. So we moved to San Diego, and that didn't stop the experiences. We live out in the country in rural San Diego County. And, you know, they always have your forwarding address. They always know where you are. And so I had a lot of incidents, but they started to change somewhat. I would have more sort of symbolic things happen. Like a couple of examples. I'm with a group of CERO members from LA at the International UFO Conference in Arizona. And we're all sitting around outside of the facility in the dark, you know, in chairs. And I had snuck a bottle of wine down from my room because the bar stopped serving people outside. And so we're all having a great time. And then we all go to bed, excited about the next day's program. The next day, every member of our group had something weird happen. And it was interesting because when they knew the time, it was like we each had 15-minute increments. My instance was I was laying in bed and it was about 3:30. I want to say 3:33 because that happens a lot, but I can't remember the exact time, but it was about 3:30. And between myself where I'm laying in bed and the TV, not in the TV, a three-dimensional oblong object just appeared in front of me and had sort of like a mist of light that sort of formed into a circle. And then it showed, and then all of a sudden it appeared, and I could have reached out and touched it, but I was just amazed because it was like right at the foot of my bed up in the air. It was like a 2-foot domino. But on the top half of the domino, it had a classic UFO, you know, it's lenticular shape. And it had a like a light beam cut into the sort of the metallic looking domino going down and pointing down and then into the second half of the domino like object. There was a DNA strand, but instead of the normal number of DNA, you know, ribbons or whatever they are, there were hundreds of them. And I said to myself, I've got to remember this. I've got to, this means something. I need to remember this. And I just kept saying that to myself. And the bottom half of the domino disappeared. Top half stayed there for a few seconds. As soon as the bottom half disappeared, I forgot everything that it was, except that it was shaped like around the laser beam or whatever it was. The DNA strands had some message, and I totally forgot what it was immediately. And other people, one couple had a bunch of rocks that their kids had been playing with. And when they came back out, they were all piled in a stack. Now, that could have been anyone, but we all had something happen weird. And a lot of us, frankly, never talked to each other again afterwards. We sort of separated. Not everyone in the group, but a lot of us, you know, sort of left the group. And it was interesting how that happened. But I've had a couple of times with symbols like that. And it always starts with sort of a oblong-shaped object. I've even had a paranormal experience like this one time. And then something appears out of it. So something was told to me. And Yvonne used to say, when the time comes, you'll remember. When you need to know, you will. And she's heard that from many experiencers. And so had that. And then a lot of my experiences, I'd say lately, skipping ahead, are more synchronistic things or more, you know, coincidences, that kind of thing. Like one time I was laying in bed reading a book called Owls and Synchronicity by Mike Cleland. And my wife goes, "What are you reading?" And I said, "A book about owls and synchronicity." "What's that?" "Well, it's sort of how owls tend to be involved in a lot of paranormal activity." And as soon as I start talking about it, an owl on our roof right above us starts hooting. And then at the other end of the house, catty-cornered from where we were sleeping, another owl starts hooting back to them. And it goes back and forth for about 5 minutes. And that's never, we have owls around here, but I've never had that kind of behavior before. And it was right whenever I was talking about owls and synchronicity.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
probably my most eventful series of paranormal experiences happened in 2019. I was, a bunch of us in Cerro decided to go up to Pine Ridge, South Dakota, to the Ogallala Sioux Reservation there, go to a consciousness seminar. It was rough facilities. It was a lot of fun. Most of us slept in a bunkhouse, a co-ed bunkhouse, and people from all over the country, and it was very nice. And I can't think of a person that didn't have a paranormal experience there. Whitley Strieber was one of the presenters. He was there too, and he's talked about it in his shows a lot. The people I met that I was closest to during those 3 days, I'm still friends with today. One of my experiences a lot of people saw UFOs. I didn't see one of those. But on the last night, Whitley was talking after dinner. It was a Sunday night. And I was sitting at the door wondering when it's going to start. It was a little disorganized. And the head of the house, Dallas Chief Eagle, was sitting on the other side of the door from me. And Whitley walked past us, put his leather jacket down right next to me. The screen door was shut on the place. But all of a sudden, coming through the door and flying in sort of a looping pattern was a white moth. And while most of the people would hang with each other, I sort of hung out mornings, and around, times when things were happening or people were gathering, I would sit with the locals who were working the event, and we'd sit out and they'd drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. And we'd talk about, how the leaves turn. And I grew up in the country, so we had a lot in common. So I had more fun doing that than the paranormal stuff. So I got used to seeing the types of animals and insects that were around there. And I'd never seen a white moth like this. And it flew in this up and down pattern. And when it got leather jacket, it just disappeared. Throw my mouth open and can't believe it. And I turn over to Dallas Chief Eagle, who was a pretty mellow person and not one to, display a lot of emotion around strangers. And he said, "Did you see it too?" And what he saw is this moth flying a kind that he'd never seen before. And he saw it fly into Whitley's jacket. I saw it disappear just before, but we were at different angles. And so we're sitting there trying to figure out what happened. Whitley comes, picks up his jacket, puts it on, walks up to the front where he's going to give his presentation, and says, "Let me start by showing a short video." And he shows a video from some holiday event his website group or his employees or helpers all had. And his wife, Anna, died that year. And so the video he's showing is a white moth coming, doing the same pattern I saw, flying through the room, and then it planted itself on a particular individual that Ann Streeper had liked a lot. He was very helpful to her, and he was Jeremy Valeri, I think his name is. And so it was like, and then they showed two or three more videos with the same white moth flying in the same pattern that other friends of Whitley had seen. They took the picture up, took their cell phone cameras and took picture of it, sent it to him and said, "You're not going to believe me, Whitley, but this is Ann sending me a message." And so I never talked to Whitley about it. when someone's famous like that at an event like that, they get crowded around, and having worked for politicians, I know to keep my distance from people and let them have their own space. So that was probably one of the more interesting things that's happened to me, even though it was just, some people would say, well, it's just an insect.
I think after Ann Streeber had passed, I think she was a very big help on the other side to Whitley.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I'm a subscriber to his, but I'm not a big watcher of those kinds of programs. So I tend to rotate around my subscriptions and watch them for three or four times and then go back to reading. I can read faster than I can listen to people talk. Yeah, he's talked about it often.
I've been meaning to get him on the show for years. The biggest problem is obviously he's extraordinarily busy in any case. But because this show basically runs on emails, so it's people reaching out to me. So it leaves me very little time or space to actually reach out to people. It does happen now and again. But I remember writing to Whitley because of the Communion book. I think it was 1992 or 1993.
Wow.
And it was to do with my father's experiences. So I'd written to Whitley, and I still have the same book I had all those years ago, and I actually got a reply. It was a typed reply. It was just basically saying that we've received the experiences, and we've now added them to the, I think it was the Communion Foundation, which was a group of scientists that were processing all this information.
Right.
And I still have that same letter after all these years as a bookmark in the book. So when I do eventually get Whitley on, I will ask him, you know, whatever become of the foundation.
I think that his files are at Rice University in Houston, Texas. That's my memory of where they are.
Okay, to look into that. And that, is that still active, do you know?
No, there are several universities that actually have. Rice has that.
And I also actually did have Mike on as well, the owl guy, he likes to be known. And it was good having him on because after that, I'd have people saying, where can I contact Mike? I too have been seeing owls. I've had this happen. And so it's great having Mike on and all the synchronicities, which is a recurring theme in all this, as well as the symbols. I think it's a good way if it's communication is exactly what it is. Do you recall any of the messages they were trying to relay to you? I know you said it will, if it hasn't, it may come to you in the future. But do you believe there's any particular reason you were in contact?
Yes. I think the purpose for me is to continue to goad Congress into doing something about the UAP. I honestly think that. My 65th birthday was December 16th, 2017. That's the day the Politico and the New York Times released the three videos that Lou Elizondo got declassified. An interesting time for me because for 25 years, I had told people that when I retire, I was going to write a book about California election law because there is no guide to how to handle election cases in California, which is a very, you know, California is bigger than a lot of countries. And from watching the U.S. from afar, you can tell that we have a lot of really bad election attorneys. And so that was my goal always to do that. And this, my birthday, my 65th birthday had this event basically changed everything. And we've been living with it ever since. And as soon as that happened, a switch flipped in me and I started writing my current book about the Robertson panel and how the debunking started against people that study UFOs or have not just lights in the sky, but structured craft pictures, that kind of thing. And I worked on that for up until 2020. And then in June of 2020, the Senate Intelligence Committee, through its chair, Marco Rubio, the Republican from Florida, asked the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to give them an update on what they're doing, what's going on about UAP. And once that came out, I dropped my book and started writing another book, which I finished in 6 months from start to finish, called The UFO Briefing Book, Congressional Guide to the UAP Phenomenon. And I had it self-published. But my purpose wasn't to sell books. And so what I did is I bought 300 copies and sent over 200 to Congress, to members of the National Security Committees, sent them each one, and a follow-up letter And then I sent about 50 or 75 to the press, which was a total waste of time. And I got it published and sent to Congress by the end of April 2021. And then the report, the UAP report from the UAP Task Force through the Office of the Director of National Intelligence was distributed. And so I gave them sort of a, here's what's going to happen. They're going to slow walk everything. They're going to delay. They're not going to tell you everything. You're going to have to find it for yourself. You're going to have to do things like, you know, make special provisions to protect whistleblowers. You're going to have to make special provisions to require them to start releasing UFO documents. You have to have special protections. You have to set up a procedure. And so I used my government background to come up with the things they needed to do. Now, I'm talking about the book. Former retired city manager who read it for me, who has no interest in the field, after he finished it, he said, Jim, that's just a 128-page staff report. You know, and the joke has always been, I just crossed out wastewater treatment plant and put in UAP. So the legislation largely follows what I was recommending. Now, I'm talking about the book. It really, I never did a Kindle version. I went on two podcasts and found it to be a waste of time. I wasn't going to, because it was written more in bureaucrat ease. And the goal was to move the ball, because we don't, till recently, there are no think tanks. There's no political platform for UAP for either party. There's no academic institutions to write about it. And so why not me? I was a pretty good writer as a, you know, writing staff reports, appellate briefs, those kinds of legal documents. But I tried to draft something with an audience in mind of about 200 people. And so I sent that out and never heard a word back. But I sent a copy to Harry Reid. He was retired, and it was about 3 months before he passed away. And he sent me an encouraging note saying that he thought the book was done well, and that he would thank my interest in this vital subject. And that was my big... Now, it's funny. I've written other letters to Congress where people will send me, please send this form letter to Congress. And so I've done the generic form letter that people do. And I've gotten responses from Congress on those. Thank you for your response. And it's always Dianne Feinstein, the late senator from California, came up with the form letter on UAP. And now every congressman and senator has some variation of it. And so working in politics for 40 years, you can spot a form letter pretty quickly. And so I've gotten those, but through other sources, I've heard that it had some influence, but the president doesn't call me. But I'm happy they're moving in the right direction, whether I had anything to do with it or not. I did go back to my original book, and that's the one that's out now, just came out, and it's called Threat to the Body Politic, Foo Fighters to UAP. Threat to the Body Politic is a shortened version of a quote out of the Robertson panel's report that interest in UFO study is a threat to the protective organs of the body politic. And that's what gave license to them recommending that UFO groups be watched, and that the national security agencies should be given the authority to take away the aura that is around that the subject has unfortunately required. And so I was reading lots of books about the Robertson panel, but they're all about how they got it wrong that UFOs are real. But no one looked at the civil liberties aspects of it, because what I did is I tracked down through declassified records, I tracked down many instances where people would take a picture of a UFO. And it wasn't just any old UFO. It was one where a great picture up close, that kind of thing. One example, in 1960, a guy named Joseph Perry, who owned a pizza parlor in Flint, Michigan, was an amateur astronomer, and he took 20 pictures of the moon one night in winter, clear winter night, which is great for sky watching, I guess. 18 of them were overexposed. One showed a picture of the moon, and according to the FBI files, one showed an unusual object that was somewhere between his telescope and the surface of the moon, is how they described it. And it was basically a classic flying saucer. So Joseph Perry didn't know what he had filmed, wasn't interested in UFOs, ran a pizza parlor. You probably didn't have time to watch the news. So he took the picture in and showed it around to a few of his customers. And they said, "That's a UFO." And he goes, "Really? Well, I better do something about that." So what he did is he went straight to the FBI office, the local FBI office in Detroit, and gave it to them and said, "Please take this to the proper authorities. And I want my picture back unless they tell me it's top secret." So the local FBI office, what they did is they sent it over to Selfridge Air Force Base, which is the nearest Air Force base, to the office, the Air Force Office of Intelligence, OSI it's called. Somehow through one of his customers, it got into the news and they contacted him. And so he told the local paper about it. So Project Blue Book at the time had a newspaper clipping service. And so they would look at newspapers from around the country. They had 158 newspapers on their clipping service. And that was before the internet. And they would literally clip out articles and send it to the subscriber on the subject they wanted. And so it got out in the paper. And so all of a sudden, NICAP and a bunch of UFO, as Perry called them, societies, came to talk to him, interview him. And they all told him, "You'll never get your pictures back." So he wrote a letter to President Eisenhower asking that the president make sure he gets his pictures back. Well, that created a big kerfuffle. Within 8 days of him sending a letter from Detroit to Washington, D.C., it went from the president's office to J. Edgar Hoover's desk in 8 days. And Hoover wrote to the local FBI office and asked to be kept apprised. And so in the FBI files, there are like 20 different documents, about 10 or 12 memos that went from the local office on a almost daily basis just to J. Edgar Hoover, nobody else, keeping him apprised of what was going on. And eventually, Hoover wrote directly to Joe Perry saying, "We've done everything we can. The Air Force has your photo. Please contact them from now on." And he took that and thanked the director, wrote back and thanked the director. And that's all. It's all in the declassified files. And the Air Force has nothing in its files about it. That was part of, they had a program to basically find out through newspaper articles where good UFO pictures were taken. Air Force officers would show up, take the pictures in the originals. And this is post-World War II, where people had real trust in the government, pre-Vietnam War, pre-Watergate. And so people just turned, you know, they all had something in common. I have several chapters on this. They had no interest in the subject ahead of time. They wanted to get their pictures to the authorities so the government could figure out what was going on. They would turn them over and never get them back. And if they complained, they were called hoaxers. So it was pretty much a common plan. They don't need that today, because today all you have to do is some skeptic has to just post something that says Photoshop, and everyone assumes the pictures aren't real. And the better the pictures are of a UFO, the more likely they're not real. Technology's done the Air Force's job. And so I go through some of the other stuff like that, but I wanted to use my legal experience and my knowledge of government records and procedures to try to explain what was behind the Robertson panel and why they did it and what the result was. One document I found was drafted about 15 days after the Robertson panel met. The Robertson panel finished on January 17th, 1953. January 20th, 1953, Eisenhower took the oath of office. On January 30th, the first meeting about what happened with the Robertson panel took place on something called the One Committee. It was basically the CIA's committee that they helped project what's going to happen in the future. And they had a bunch of CIA staffers, a retired general, unnamed, and a retired ambassador, and a gentleman named Dr. Edgar Hoover, which is J. Edgar Hoover. That was on January 30th. By February 6th, the FBI office in Los Angeles sent an FBI agent to meet with a rocket scientist at North American Aviation. And that rocket scientist was not your typical rocket scientist. He was like the assistant to Wernher von Braun building the V-2 rocket. He was brought over to the U.S. by the CIA in Operation Paperclip. And he was ran a program on rocketry at North American Aviation. In his spare time, he worked for volunteer for an organization called Civilian Saucer Investigators of Los Angeles. And they applied scientific principles to the study of UFOs. They had a lot of members. There were scientists and engineers at North American and the other defense contractors. And in fact, the scientist worked on was a source for a story in Life magazine, the picture magazine that was on people's coffee tables in America in the 50s and 60s. And what they came up with was a story that was the case for extraterrestrial visitation. And that was the name of the story. And on the cover of one of the issues in the right-hand corner was a reference to that article and what page it was in. On the cover of that edition was Marilyn Monroe. It was the biggest selling Life magazine ever. And it wasn't for the UFO story, but it had a big circulation. And so CSILA got an international following and people kept sending. This is a mom and pop organization formed around, you know, kitchen tables. And they got a reputation because they were one of the first that applied scientific principles to the study on the other side. So the Robertson panel had listed them as one of the two organizations that needed to be watched, and they used the term watched. And so when they met with this scientist, he was told that it would be a professional embarrassment for him by the FBI agent and that he should stop this hobby of his. Within 3 days, he wrote this agent, wrote a memo to the Office of Scientific Intelligence, OSI, and the CIA. No copies to anyone else. A CIA, an FBI agent just writing directly to the CIA, to the group in charge of UFO issues at a time when them being in charge was only known within the CIA. And so they have the contact memo that explains what was done by the FBI to stop this guy. And so this guy left the group. So did the rest of the scientists and engineers, because they were all worried about their security clearances. They didn't want to meet with an FBI agent. The FBI's role with classifications is they can remove your classification you know, if they make a recommendation to do so. So you could lose your livelihood as a scientist or an engineer. So within a year, CSILA disappeared. It just folded up and stopped doing it, which left the field pretty much with UFO clubs, saucer clubs, versus the Air Force's explanation. And so little steps like that created big holes in the UFO community. So that's why I wanted to write the book, to talk about just the civil rights aspects of that. Because in America, we have a First Amendment. And under the First Amendment, people have a freedom of association right. In other words, just to engage in free speech, you have to be able to talk to other people. Who you get to associate with and how is up to you. Unless you're plotting to bomb something or do something illegal, you have an absolute right to choose what you believe. And so what they've done is they took this scientist and took away his rights and other scientists to associate with people on a subject they wanted to associate about. And so when other people look at this and think of UFOs, and I'm thinking of what violations of law occurred, because I practiced constitutional law for decades, and it just stuck out to me as a sore thumb. So that's pretty much what my book's about, with a little bit about today's, how yesterday has created the stigma that exists today in the intransigence of the Air Force, CIA in particular, to keep their secrets to themselves.
And it certainly makes you wonder, you know, how far they've actually gone to keep this secret. You know, there's been many stories over the years. And of course, this all didn't begin in 2017. You know, a lot of people which are new to the subject, this dates back. James, for people who are interested in your book, where can they get copies?
Amazon, pretty much, let's see, UK, Europe, US, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. At bookstores there, you can order them, or just order them on Amazon. I'm supposed to have a Kindle version, and I've been waiting 3 weeks for it to pop up. I know a gentleman in England, Steve Aspen, wrote a book, and it took Amazon 3 months to post it. He wrote a UFO book. And so sometimes those things tend to happen. As my children say, operating error and Jim are synonymous. Too many people have had strange events like that. But the book is, you can order it, you know, online, and or order it through your local bookstore.
And James, you also have a website.
Yes, that's jplufo.com. JPL is my, I'm James Patrick Lowe. So I don't get sued for copyright with the Jet Propulsion Lab, which I used to live next to or near. On that website, I do blogs. Luckily, my son is very tech savvy, and he's made it look presentable, because it was pretty much hilarious before. And so he straightened it out. But right now I'm doing a series. I'm not selling anything on the website. I'm doing a series of blogs on congressional interest in this and how they should do it. Right now, I've started a series. Just before we came on, I was finishing up my third in the series, and it's about how disclosure should happen through Congress. You know, a lot of people in the UFO community say that government will never do anything, that it's going to come from the people. But from my perspective, it's in government right now. They hold the keys, and I'm going to do my best to give them examples to use to put forward how to make it public. Because to me, the discovery that we're being visited by non-human entities from other dimensions, I call it non-terrestrial, because we don't know it's extraterrestrial. We don't know if they're from another planet or another dimension or another time or whatever. So I usually use the term non-terrestrial. But that will be very, how that gets unfolded is going to be very important, because you and I talk, and your listeners, you know, they're pretty savvy about this stuff. or else they wouldn't be listening to this, or else they're learning about it. But the average person doesn't know. And there were, having worked with politicians and also represented political campaigns and initiatives, ballot measures, I've done a lot of work with polling companies, because a lot of times candidates or interest groups that want to push a particular, you know, ballot measure for a community will hire pollsters, and they'll want the attorney who's going to draft whatever language they're working on or help with the platform of the candidate to make sure it's legal, would have me at these meeting with their pollsters. And so I learned a lot about polling, doing that kind of work. And also I have done one of my specialties was election law. The thing is that there's been recent polling, and it's starting to really matter. An organization called YouGov, which does really quality polls, in September of 2022, put out a poll that had a question that, is the government hiding anything about extraterrestrials? Well, there are two polls. One was, are there extraterrestrials, non-terrestrial beings on visiting planet Earth? One third, roughly, you know, within the margin of error, roughly one third of the respondents said yes. One third of the respondents said no, because the government would tell us. And one third said they didn't know. So no matter what they come up with, two thirds of the people are going to have a problem with it. It's not going to meet their pre-existing knowledge. 56% in another poll by YouGov and 57 by another polling firm within a year of that say that the American government is hiding something. 56% of the people. So if it's going to be rolled out, they've got to be very careful how they do it.
Do you have an interest in the paranormal? Then you'll love the UnxNetwork.com. The X is your streaming audio and video for everything supernatural, strange, and mysterious, like UFOs, Bigfoot, ghosts, and so much more. From hosts like Clyde Lewis, Whitley Strieber, Micah Hanks, and Christina Gomez. Visit the UnxNetwork.com show page for a complete list of all the paranormal programs you'll find on the X. Be sure to follow us on Twitter for updates at KUNXDB. Follow our Facebook group, UnX Network. Find the podcast on Spotify, iHeart, Audible, and Apple Podcast. It's time.
It's new.
It's the X.
My blogs are sort of laying out the process that they should do. First thing, it's got to be bipartisan. If you have one party, the other roll it out, the other side's going to immediately assume it's not true. If they have it rolled out from the CIA or the Air Force, no one's going to believe them. But if you have a bipartisan membership in Congress, which on this issue, we have that pretty much. There have been some bumps, but considering they change speakers three times in a year, you know, those bumps are minor compared to what's going on right now. But you've got a majority in both houses that are interested in this. And the amazing thing about it, with the overwhelming votes for this so far, when it's been attached to either defense bills or intelligence authorization bills, is that the rank and file members of Congress are voting overwhelmingly to support this. There hasn't, until this year, there hasn't been one attempt to water down what is brought forward by these committees. And that shows that rank and file members may not know what they're seeing behind closed doors, but they trust the particular members of those committees that are in their party. And so this has come up in an unusual way. Usually issues like this come up through the grassroots with thousands of letters, a think tank, issues a policy memoranda that this has to be done, parties adopt it or oppose it. You know, that's how things come up. This didn't follow that trend. this came up totally based on what the members, particularly of the Senate Intelligence Committee, are learning behind closed doors. I sort of consider it, think about John Mack wrote just wonderful books about the abduction phenomena, or experiences, as I like to use his term. And one of the things he talks about, and other psychologists and psychiatrists have too, is the ontological shock that when you're an experiencer and you finally quit the excuses and figure out it's really happening to you, you know, your entire worldview is shattered. And that's the term for that is ontological shock. Well, that can apply to members of Congress. You're getting reports from Navy pilots saying we're seeing things we've never seen before. And if they attack us, we lose. We lose right away. But they're not attacking us. They're basically playing cat and mouse, and it just keeps going on, and it doesn't stop. So you can really tell just by the way they talk in Congress who's seen the videos and who hasn't. People like Mitt Romney, Kirsten Gillibrand, Mark Warner, Marco Rubio. You can tell when they talk. A couple of the senators, including Mitt Romney, were caught by a tabloid, one of those tabloid TV shows where they came out and were just walking down the street and they walk up and stick a camera in their face and a microphone. And what about UFOs? Mitt Romney 3-4 years ago said, they're not from here. They're from someplace else. They're not telling us the truth. Now, that didn't get much coverage, but as a former presidential candidate, another former presidential candidate, Dennis Kucinich, back in, I think it was the 1980s, 1990s, was running for president. And one of the questions he got at a forum, televised forum, was, have you seen a UFO? Because Shirley MacLaine had written about one that Dennis Kucinich saw visiting her house. And it destroyed his campaign. So why would they pick up this subject? And it's interesting that it's bipartisan because, you know, if you're going to jump off a bridge into the unknown, wouldn't you like to have the other side with you? I mean, you don't want to do it by yourself. You don't want to be the one that jumps off and everyone's standing up above laughing at you and pointing. So it's, you know, hang together or hang separately, as was said by a patriot during the Revolutionary War, Patrick Hale. There's something going on behind the scenes that's much more than what we know now. David Grush talked to them. There have been more whistleblowers talking to them, a lot of them retired, who don't have anything. And see, in the past, if you came forward, you were on an island. Bob Salas, a friend of mine, was a nuclear launch officer in the 60s, Air Force Academy graduate, and a UFO showed up over their facility. The security crew called down and said, we've got an orange UFO about 45 feet across right above us. Should we shoot? He thought they were joking, people who normally don't joke. And when the ICBMs, the 10 they were controlling, started going offline one after another, they realized it was real. Well, Bob went on Larry King Live in the 1990s and told that story. And he was literally on an island. No one in Congress would touch it. Well, things are different today. People are touching it. And I see it as not only a way to release the information in a manner that will help people along, because I really don't care about the UFO community. They're going to know. You know, they're going to be pulling people, why don't you do this faster? But it's the people that don't know, they're going to have to be convinced. And so I'm hoping, you know, writing these blogs, you know, what I'm going to do is, I did this with Bob a couple of years back. We grouped papers we wrote together and sent them to Congress. And so we sent probably 20, 25 papers to Congress on various aspects of the phenomenon. Well, I'm doing this one because there aren't many people that work with politicians, set up procedures for them to handle certain matters in a way that the public can accept. So I'm trying to use my expertise for something that, if it comes out wrong, if Vladimir Putin announces it or somebody else and mixes in disinformation with truth, you know, we could have a lot of chaos that shouldn't happen. And so my hope is they can change the way they do their hearings for this, cover a subject, sort of the January 6th insurrection hearings. Well, take the subject matter away, you know, because that's a dividing issue. Just the format that they used, it wasn't the typical 5 minutes of one congressman on one side, then 5 minutes on the other telling through the witness that the other guy's an idiot. If they do something like that, we're just going to have chaos. But if they do a series of public hearings that release an issue at a time to slowly bring people into this, I think we can do this with a lot less disruption and get the public to understand what we're talking about. And I think it might help the world a little bit, because you're going to find out, if you live in Wichita, Kansas, you have more in common with someone from, you know, Botswana than you do with someone from Zeta Reticuli. And so it might help on that front too. I'm not sure whether they were ready. You know, maybe they'll keep flying around and not do anything. Who knows? But at least people need to know that they're there and that we're not alone in this universe. I can hope. I'm a government guy, so I hope it works. Most people that have an interest in the phenomena also think government doesn't work, because look at this phenomenon, how it's never worked. So we'll see.
There's always been pushback with people which don't want this information coming out, because if this information gets rolled out in the course, there's certain elements, things that will come out will affect people which have been involved in the more insidious aspects of this. So of course, they don't want these secrets to come out. But this is the will of the people. The world is changing now. They want to know. And yes, people aren't as trusting of the government, because there's been lies after lies told. But there is plenty of interest with this now. Have you attempted to reach out to Tim Burchak?
No, I haven't, actually. Tried to strictly stay with what are called appropriate committees. When they first drafted the UAP law, they set out who are the appropriate committees to receive information in classified settings about this. And Congressman Burchett is not on any of those committees. And so I've sort of held fast to that, whether I should or not. House Oversight jumped and had the Grush hearing, which I was amazed, not by the testimony, because I knew what was going to come out with the two pilots and the intelligence officer. But what amazed me was how bipartisan the subcommittee was, because it's a subcommittee of one of the most partisan committees in Congress. I mean, they're the ones impeaching everybody, I guess. So, you know, it's not the kind of committee you expect to have that reach across the aisle. And there was one member, a woman from North Carolina, who spent her whole 5 minutes bashing the Biden administration over the Chinese balloon incident. But the rest of them, including some of the more flamboyant members like Matt Gaetz, asked good questions. I was very surprised and very heartened by that. Because, you know, to me, if they're bipartisan on this issue, that doesn't mean they're going to give up their fights on abortion or other. It's just they put their gloves down for this one issue. Isn't that amazing? It's the only issue. I can't think of another issue right now that is truly bipartisan like this. And it's not because of the public.
It is certainly a first, and it is the way forward.
When I say it's not the public, the public needs to get involved. But it didn't start with the public. It started with a bunch of Navy pilots complaining.
I think the next stage is, you know, we have these whistleblowers, military individuals which have had these experiences and people which have worked on these projects. But there does certainly need to be experiences, normal non-military experiences, which, you know, which I believe they have to have a part in this.
Oh, I agree. It's like peeling back the layers of an onion. You know, we're not the first layer, but we better be one of them. We don't want the military and the intelligence community to say, yeah, you got us. You got us. We held back because we were embarrassed. There's more to it than embarrassment, because they know about the abduction phenomena, and some say they're involved through my labs. There could be a lot behind the scenes that we don't know that's pretty bad. So we need to get those out.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I'm saying with there's going to be people which don't want this information coming out because potentially, you know, the military is involved in some of these abductions. But I think, you know, if you go by all of my guests from over the years, these are just everyday people, you know, everyday people which are having these experiences, and they back decades, decades and decades. So it's important that people come out and share these, and hopefully it gets to be part of the onion, you know, because it is important.
Yep. Well, you know, sort of bring up something that sort of, I think I was meant to do this, or at least that's my goal, or that was my mission. You know, what I'm writing is my own. I even stopped meditating while I was doing this because I just don't want any connections at all. I want to do it like I'm doing it for a client. And that's the way I'm approaching it. I've written probably 1,000 letters to Congress. A lot of them are, you know, like 100 copies to one, that kind of thing. But in addition to the 2017 articles coming out of my 65th birthday, in November 2004, I took my son, my law firm, we went on a tour of a Navy ship. One of the associates that worked for me, her husband was the chief legal officer on the Nimitz, the USS Nimitz. And so we went on, he took us on a tour. So we went on a sort of a discombobulated tour because he was a lawyer, not a tour guide, because they have different officers or people that give community tours of the ship. And so the highlight of the tour was, it was on a Friday, I think the 10th, I may get my dates wrong, but the 10th of November, we get up to the Combat Information Center. I think it's called something different now, but where, you know, the heart of the ship where command and control is. And so the executive officer was the officer of the deck. And then there were a bunch of enlisted personnel at different computer screens or radar screens or whatever they were. And we're all real quiet. It's very dark, just the light from the computer screens to be able to see where we were. And we're all crowded in there. It was a real small area. And so our tour guide asks one of them, "What are you doing?" One of the personnel. And since an officer asked him, he said, "We just got some new software upgrades and I'm calibrating it." And then the executive officer turns to the legal officer and says, "Don't you ever ask a question like that again in front of civilians." So I knew that they were calibrating some new software improvements in their radar. They set out 2 days later on Sunday. First flight goes off the deck, and that's the one that spotted the first Tic Tacs with Commander Fravor. So I was on the ship ahead of time. So fast forward about 8-9 years later, I'm at a UFO conference. It's Sunday afternoon. It's wrapping up. I'm sitting at Yvonne Smith's book table while she's doing regressions. So I can, you know, there weren't many people in there. It was closing up. And my job was to tell people, you can buy a book from me, but Yvonne's not here to sign it. And they always walk away. But no one steals the books with me sitting there. Across from me was a gentleman named Kevin Day. And so there was no one around. So we just started talking back and forth, and I didn't know him. And it turns out Kevin was the chief petty officer on the USS Princeton, which is the Aegis cruiser in the Nimitz Task Force. And that's the main radar for the whole carrier group. And he was, you know, the supervisor of it. And he was on board. He was in charge of that unit when the Tic Tacs started showing up. And he said that they had just gotten new software and they were calibrating it, and they figured they were just mistakes. So they recalibrated everything. They shut it down and restarted and recalibrated everything. And the Tic Tacs actually turned up sharper. And so Kevin said to me, he thought that the software upgrades let them see something that might have always been there or been there a lot that they couldn't see before. And so I got a front row seat before the Nimitz event on the Nimitz, and talk about synchronicities.
Back to synchronicities again. Isn't that interesting? It makes you wonder that this upgrade was maybe deliberate, with maybe prior knowledge done so they could observe these UFOs.
Whether it was intentional or accidental, the result is they started seeing them. And talking to Kevin Day about it, to watch someone speak personally about it, and he was not that comfortable at the time talking about it. But just seeing the emotion in his face, you know, as a lawyer, you're always trying to judge the credibility of people you're dealing with, you know, in the courtroom or in the city council chambers or in a meeting where you're negotiating. I've always felt I have a little bit of a sixth sense in that regard. I can't put my finger on it, but I don't trust this person. It makes a lot of sense to me what they're saying. I was always a negotiator that most of the time I was representing the government. I usually didn't play around. I just said, here's my bottom line, and I never change. If you don't believe me, I'll give you a list of people I've negotiated with. So it always strikes people funny when a lot of times they don't trust it. They're used to the old game where you come up 5,000, they go down 5,000, and eventually 3 hours later, you meet in the middle. And I was on the public payroll at the time on an hourly rate. And so I used to always try to cut to the chase. But credibility, you know, watching Kevin Day, it was emotionally gut-wrenching for him to do it. Because talk about ontological shock. You know, no training, no nothing. And in fact, he said, and he's said this publicly many times, that after the incidents, there were people in Air Force uniforms came on board and took all the radar data and all the tapes of all the sensors and left. It was interesting. At the end of December, as Sean Kirkpatrick was leaving Aero to retire, he was interviewed by, I think, one of the defense publications, saying, and he said that people are always asking us to look at the Nimitz situation. And I'm telling him we look at modern things, not the Nimitz, because 24 hours after they're used, they erase the tape, the data, and lay down new data. And I know that's false about that incident. Whether he knows it or not, I don't know. But that somebody took those tapes away, and they were tapes back in 2004, big magnetic data tapes. They took those away, and they're someplace, and the answer is right there, unless they've destroyed them.
Oh, yeah, I guarantee they'd be locked away somewhere.
Yes.
It's all important data. That's wonderful, James. Now, to our listeners, if you're interested in getting copies of James's books, that's the UFO Briefing Book, A Guide to Congressional Oversight of the UAP Phenomena, and Body Politic, Foo Fighters to UAPs. And I'll make them all available on the website and below this episode.
Thanks.
James, I really appreciate you coming on, sharing it all for our listeners.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure is all ours, James. Keep in contact, and we will speak soon.
I will.
Take care, James. That is all for this episode. Keep updated and connected with the show on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you'd like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com, or you can reach out to me via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to James for sharing tonight, and thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.